Armed with a preoccupation with trailblazers and with the intention to share their expertise, Paige Parker launched her podcast, Pass the Power. An author, a passionate patron of the arts and local fashion designers, a board member of United Women Singapore, a TEDx speaker, a GAA gemologist, and even spin instructor, Parker is the opposite of an autodidact. She is the ultimate apprentice, eager to expand her knowledge from the masters. She's also a self-proclaimed tiger mum, an avid adventurer, with a Guinness Book World Record under her fashionable belt. Join me, Yvette King, as Paige Parker passes the power to Vogue Uncut. So nice to have you here, Paige.
Thank you, Yvette.
Yes, welcome to Vogue Uncut.
Oh, thank you. I'm excited to be here, flattered to be here, and looking forward to a great conversation.
Yes. And now your name, Paige Parker, I feel like you were destined to be a broadcast journalist or a podcaster with a name like that.
I wanted to be Barbara Walters when I was growing up. I don't know. Are you old enough to know who she is?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, so yeah, that was like Barbara Wawa and I loved her and I thought it would happen and it didn't.
Well,
other things happened, but yeah, it's a great name. When I was married, I didn't take my husband's name for many reasons, but also because Paige Parker is a nice name.
It's a great name. It just rolls off the tongue. Mm. And I love how your book is titled Don't Call Me Mrs. Rogers. Mm. What did your husband, Jim, think about that?
He was like, you don't need to cut anything. I was like, is there anything I need to cut? But the reason that I did Don't Call Me Mrs. Rogers is because I think ultimately you want to have a title that people go, who does she think she is? Or what is that all about? Mm-hmm. But after traveling around the world, I think seeing the third class status of women who are mostly defined by men, that was the bigger part of it. Don't call me Mrs. Rogers because I'm not Mrs. Rogers. I'm Paige Parker.
Yes.
End of the day, if I'm called Mrs. Rogers, it's not an insult.
No.
But I think for the title, there was a lot more to it than just that sassy, don't call me Mrs. Rogers.
Mm-hmm. And your book is all about your epic world tour. But growing up in a place like Rocky Mount, which I read, I think it was like 50,000 people population. So that's, you know, pretty small.
Pretty small.
Had you done much travel prior to going on this odyssey?
When I met Jim, I was 26 and I had traveled through Europe.
Mm-hmm.
I'd spent some time studying in London and that's kind of it.
Wow.
So when he talked about going around the world, I said, sign me up. I'd read his book about his prior trip going around the world. And I was like, sign me up. This is going to be incredible. Having these notions of it would just be going from fabulous to fabulous. And then pretty quickly, I realized that's in the movies. That's not real life and it's not the world.
Right.
And the trip itself, Jim obviously was a catalyst for me to take off and go around the world. But after probably 3 months on the road, I realized that his empathy was not high and that if I needed him to get around the world, I should go home. And I had to make the trip more about me.
Mm.
And that's when I really started seeking out women to talk to, women's markets. I mean, things going to the ballet, the things that really drive me and interest me. I didn't go to the stock market once, the stock exchange once. That's his thing. And I had to make it so that I was fed along the way enough by the world. And it wasn't just Jim.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's true.
No, when I
was in
Rocky
someone's
Mount,
shadow or, yeah, you know, following along for their journey.
Yes.
You had to find your own path.
Right.
Around the world.
Which I still continue to try to do today because, and that's probably one of the reasons I didn't become Barbara Walters is because Jim is such a huge presence and he was already, by the time I met him, he was already at a point where he was known, he was successful, he'd already retired, he was financially independent. And I moved into that world. And so I went from being kind of a star in my own right to being kind of in his aura.
Yeah, so you were the main character in your world.
Yes.
And then you met another main character, really.
Yes. So it was a challenge for me to find my way. But ultimately, the trip, it taught me so much about myself. It was the education of Paige. People talk about they've been to Russia when they've only been to Moscow. People say they've been to the US and they've only been to New York. I mean, I was in 116 countries over 3 years, 1,101 days.
Yes.
I was counting.
Yeah. 1,101. Yep. Yes. I've got that here in my notes.
And we were, we both received Guinness World Records for doing it.
I know.
So it's an incredible, impressive feat. And you learn so much about yourself. You see that the world is full of really resilient women, resourceful women. And coming home from that, I think I just was such a better version of myself to go into the next phase of my life. So the journey was far more the travel. The journey was far more than two people who actually made it around the world for 3 years. Mm-hmm. It's hard to travel with someone, and to do overland is incredibly hard.
A lot of relationships, friendships as well, don't last a short trip.
Yeah. Driving so across America is hard for some people.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very vast land, let alone the entire globe.
Yes.
And then you were also held at gunpoint?
Yes, we were held at gunpoint in Angola. And this was when they were fighting over diamonds, UNITA and the government. And to make a very long story short, we were stopped just as the sun went down. And the boy soldiers, and I say boy soldiers because they were boys, you know, in their teens. Mm. And they had machine guns, they had machetes, and they stopped us.
My heart's palpitating. This is very serious.
It was. I mean, I feared for my life. And up until then, when we'd been traveling through Angola, whenever they stopped us, we had some bribes and things that we would kind of pass along to the soldiers, and they would kind of forget us and we would keep going. Mm-hmm. But this was a large group. I would say there were probably 12 to 14 of the soldiers. And I slept in the car that night. I mean, we have a tent, but Jim was like, shall we pitch the tent? And I'm like, I'm not getting out of the car.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, even when I had to go to the bathroom, it was like barely getting out so you could go. I was incredibly scared. And then the next morning, oh, and it's so funny. I was so mad at Jim. I blamed him for us being in this situation that we had a few things in the, we had a special made car, which I should tell you about later, but in the trunk, we had like some canned food and stuff. And I remember we had a tin of peaches left and I would not share with him.
You're like, I'm this eating is my treat.
The peaches. You got me here. These are my peaches. but then the next morning, Jim took out a Polaroid camera. And this is 20 years ago because, I mean, now it's hard for people to comprehend that people haven't seen a picture of themselves. But to take a Polaroid and see yourself, all of the soldiers were like, this is crazy. And then they went and got their general
came out.
And they were also enamored by the Polaroid.
So Polaroid saved your life.
And then,
in not so many words.
Yes. And then they got all of their ammunition, stood in a group there with Jim in the middle. So you've got all the soldiers, rocket launchers, machetes, machine guns, like all of this stuff. And I'm taking pictures going, like all the international magazines in the world and the newspapers would just die to be able to like get this shot, right? And the general came out and he spoke a bit of English and basically explained to us that they had mined the bridge just as we arrived, because it was almost sundown. And they put mines under the bridge, so you can't come and attack the camp.
Oh.
And so if they hadn't stopped us at gunpoint and we drove across the bridge.
Okay, this is the burnt toast theory.
Yes, we would have been blown to bits. So they saved our lives.
Wow. That is a very, very crazy story. Did that experience sort of change your view on things, on life?
I mean, I had been very reticent to drive through Angola in the first place. And we actually left on my mom's birthday. And I try not to have regret in life because all of our problems and failures and things teach us something, right?
It's true. It's a futile emotion, really.
But I had regret. I was like, this was really insane that we've done it.
Yeah.
And then also this notion that you have such fear over the people who are saving your life and how you wrap your head around that. And it was, but honestly, we couldn't dwell on it too much because we were continuing on and we
places
went from
to go.
Yeah.
People to see.
Angola and Botswana and South Africa and continuing on. But yeah, they saved our lives.
It is wild.
It is. It is. But it also because we didn't speak the local language, obviously. And it just, I think that if I could be a fairy godmother and anoint anything on travelers, it would be the ability to speak every language.
Wouldn't that be incredible?
Because, yeah.
Like, you know, the Matrix, how they put in a program and they can just download it straight away.
Yeah.
That would be incredible if you could just speak any language.
Yeah.
I'm sure with technological advancements, there's going to be a lot of easy, you know, translation devices.
Oh,
and
for
apps
sure. Now
and things.
It would be
exactly.
I was
it
thinking
would be
about,
much easier now, yeah. wouldn't it?
I was thinking about that because when we did it, there was no, I mean, there was no satellite.
Don't tell me you had a Gregory's map and you were.
We had for Africa, we had paper maps that we bought in London.
Oh,
we spent
that's
about 3 weeks.
That's unbelievable,
preparing.
Isn't
yeah.
it?
And there was a phone called Iridium, which looked like a brick, and it went bankrupt just as we went into Africa.
Oh.
So literally, I think people can't imagine that now you have an app where you can, you know, get your hotel.
Yeah.
Where we didn't know where we were going to sleep. We didn't know where we were going to find food.
Wow.
We didn't know where we were going to find fuel. And
what an adventure.
It was an absolute adventure. It was heaven and hell.
Mm-hmm.
It was as good as life can get. And some of the most profound adventures were the ones that you probably wouldn't expect. Maybe you would think it would be the Ritz in Paris. No, it was the ones that you can't pay for. Like in Ivory Coast, we happened on a place where the son had a boombox, you know, the old days,
yeah,
the boombox.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was playing Let's Get It On. Who is that? Lou Reed. And mm-hmm. I was like, I kind of moved and he moved. And then I was like this. And he's like, come with me. And he took me to his mom in the back and she pointed at a chicken, which is walking around. And I was like, yeah, for sure. So we had fried chicken for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And she had the only ice box, a cooler in town, which was full of Flag beer, which is the local beer. And so we bought beer for everybody who came. We had the music playing and we were dancing. We were eating fried chicken. And like the bill was $12.
This is what life is about.
That you American Express, nobody can plan that holiday.
Yeah.
You've got to drive around the world, suffer through some crazy times, and then you end up on something that is profoundly
priceless.
Yeah, priceless.
So what would you say to 30-year-old Paige standing next to the canary yellow coupe?
Mm. Gosh, I'm glad you did it.
Mm. It's going to be tough, but keep going.
Yeah. Yeah. Because when Jim and I talked about going around the world, I was working in New York. I had just gotten, and when I originally started working in North Carolina, I worked for a nonprofit. When I moved to New York, I worked for a for-profit because I had to pay the very expensive rent in New York.
Oh, yeah.
And I had just gotten my first promotion, and I was making real money for the first time in my life. And it became a time where I had to decide, will I go around the world with this guy who I've fallen in love with, or do I stay here? And I just remember thinking that if I don't go, one day when I'm old and 50, I'm now 55. When I'm old and 50, I'll look back and think, you know, why didn't you do that?
Yeah.
I would have regret. And then I thought, if I go and I fail, I'll come home. I'll have my head tucked in shame, but I'll get another job and life will go on. But at least I will have tried.
It's true.
So I'm really glad that I took the leap and the profound learnings from it, personally, as well as just understanding the world better, shaped me into a better human being.
Mm. And then fast forward to 2007, you relocated to Singapore because you saw it as the future. Is that right?
Yes. Yes.
So has it lived up to your, I guess, futuristic expectations?
Well, 17 years later, we're still here.
Mm-hmm.
And both of my daughters now have left the nest. Instead of an empty nester, I prefer to be a bird launcher. I know it sounds so corny, but
I like that rebrand.
Somebody said that to me on Instagram and I was like, I'm a bird launcher.
Yeah.
And one is in university in New York, her last year, and one is in England, sixth form boarding school. And so I'm now here with Jim and the two dogs and there's nowhere else I wanna go.
Mm.
I don't
it's
have to be
place.
Here anymore. So
yeah.
I think this is one of the best places to live. It's a great place to travel from. And I think that we made the right decision also by rearing our daughters here because they grew up bilingual in English and in Chinese and Mandarin.
So
they went through the local system. It was very difficult to get them in, but they went through the local system. And beyond kind of being the language helping them through life, it helped them learn to assimilate, deal with other cultures, to be resilient. So it was a great learning curve for them. They also learned, in my opinion, on a higher level than if we'd probably stayed in New York or if they'd gone to an international school, because the level of study here is incredibly high. And they were in a Chinese or a SAP school, a Chinese-centric school, which is quite tough. And they learned how to think and critical thinking, and but they also learned empathy, I think. And as AI becomes so much more important, like the critical thinking, the empathy, the things that make us human is what's going to make us stand out. And I think they're very grounded in that through what they learned here in Singapore.
I was watching YouTube videos of Bea and Hilton, and someone in the comments said, "I'm a native Mandarin speaker and they speak better than me."
Yeah.
That is so incredible. Why was the bilingual factor so important for you?
Well, my husband had been telling people you need to teach your children Chinese for a very long time. He was optimistic that China in the next 20, 50 years is going to be incredibly important. So then we had children, and, you know, it's kind of walking the talk. Also, when we went around the world, I love China. There's such a work ethic. There's, I mean, they go from 0 to 1,000 like that.
It's true.
They're amazing. And this notion of learning Mandarin, I also had done enough homework to know that it's a difficult language. It's not something you kind of just pick up.
Yeah.
And so when they were born, we brought a Laosher into the house, and we had the Chinese nanny. So they learned Chinese the same way that they learned English. So when Hilton was 2, the first time we took her to China, and people were like, "How did you learn Chinese?" And she's like, "I didn't. You know, this is the same way I learned English.
I just grew up like
that." She cooked in Chinese. She did art in Chinese. I asked the Chinese Laosher to be her Chinese mama, to give her what I couldn't. And I think for us, it was wanting them to know Asia, to feel comfortable in Asia, so that in their lifetimes, they will obviously be citizens of the world, but also have the ability to, if you close your eyes, you think they are Chinese.
That's wonderful. I think it's a real jump start in life for them to have something like that, for sure. But let's talk about your podcast. So in your podcast trailer, you say that you've been curious about successful people all your life. Where did this enchantment begin?
I think it's this whole aspiration of wanting to be successful. I mean, I've always wanted to be in a room filled with people who are curious and engaging and bright, and that tends to be someone who is successful, right? And then the podcast, when I first started building it, it was the who's who of Singapore. Tommy Koh, former ambassador to the UN, was my first guest. I mean, I've had the CEO of DBS, Piyush Gupta. And then as we got into a couple seasons, I was like, okay, let's talk to some artists. let's talk to some, you know, museum directors and not just the who's who. And I think the biggest pull from all of these people, as diverse as the guests are, is that they don't define success in the way that we often do, which is wealth and material. And success for them is more about, it's almost purpose-driven, and more than making money. It's about being happy with yourself, following like your true path, and having really good relationships. And I think that drives people to be successful. I think that's the happiest people in the world, the most successful people in the world. It's not the wealth and the material and the status. It's kind of following that inner compass and that inner goal of, I always say, because we always talk about having it all. And that's defined by whom. So when you have it all on your level of what your all is, I think you are successful.
Okay, because that was my next question. I guess success can be a little bit subjective. So, A, how do you define it? How do you arbitrate that? And so how would you answer that question for yourself? Because, I mean, you've given the answer for your guests.
I think it is knowing who you are and living that And if you do that, then you are successful, because so many people do and live and act in order to be perceived in a certain way or to meet a certain standard. And I think when you, I mean, it's a luxury, right? To be able to truly follow your true path, right? Because many people are worried about paying the rent and they're like, I just gotta get a job. Yes. Come on, what are you talking about? But I think that when you can be true to yourself and then successful in the things that you think are important, then that's success. It's not about having a trophy car. It's not about things.
No.
It's about doing what's important to you, doing good work, helping others. I mean, I'm talking, this is for me specifically.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that is my idea of success. Having children who are kind, empathetic, hardworking, having relationships that fill me and sustain me, being able to do for others and organizations and passions that are important to me. I mean, that's my success. That's my all. And a little fashion thrown in.
Yeah. I mean, why not?
and a little jewelry.
Let's talk about the art of the interview. What's your process? How do you go about it?
Lots of research on the guests. And then I try to, like you're doing now, listen far more than talk and just let people tell their stories. And I think because I've probably only had one or two on my podcast who are not innately good storytellers.
Because the guest is also key, right? Yeah. So how did you navigate those more challenging ones?
Well, for one, when we went post-production, we just sped it up a little.
That's a good nifty trick.
We did I think it was like 1.25 speed by the time it made it to, and it sounded great.
Did it?
He's just a very thoughtful, deliberate speaker.
I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Because sometimes that is hard as an interviewer to kind of work with that.
And then I think also getting them to talk about things that they haven't talked about before.
Yeah, agreed.
Because especially somebody like Chatri Sichitong from One Championship, he's been interviewed a million times. I've heard so many of his interviews and so often his responses are similar. So I wanted to make sure when we chatted that I was able to bring in some things that would be new to the listener and the viewer of the podcast. So just trying to make it a podcast where it all started. I was writing for the Straits Times during the pandemic and I had some women on Instagram write me and I just felt like I wanted to do, it sounds so hokey, but Conversations of Hope. Podcasts that would inspire leadership and resilience and just positivity.
Oh, we needed it.
Yeah.
We really needed it back then.
And to do a podcast where that comes out is very, very easy. Yeah.
And what would you say is your biggest strength as an interviewer?
Choosing the right guests.
Yeah. Good guest curation helps.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
What tools do you use to make someone feel comfortable in an interview, do you think?
I think 95% of all of the guests that I've had on have been people that I know, which really helps.
Yeah, it does. Because you've got that natural rapport.
Yes.
And you already can sense their energy. And
yes. Yes. But for those I wasn't really familiar with, I think just doing what we're doing now, just having a natural conversation.
Yeah.
Also kind of sharing with them prior to the topics we're going to go over. So they felt very comfortable because I told them all, this is not about trying to catch you in something.
No.
This is not an expose in any way.
No, no, no.
This is about letting the interviewer, let me bring out these things so that the audience will be like, wow, such an important job, but so relatable. You know, Swan Jin Bae, who at the time when I interviewed him was head of EDB and he's now a perm sec. But he talked about how when he was in his teens, he was really into fashion and liked to design fashion. Then he went to school and he got a medical degree, never practiced a day, went to STB to work. And like, you know, and people are like, you know, he did what his parents wanted him to do. And then he found his own path. And so it's just a matter of sharing things about people so that the people watching might go, oh, if he can do that, I can too.
Yeah.
Or he came from that, like Kishore Mahubani, who's just released the most incredible book. Kishore was also ambassador to the UN. He led the Lee Kuan Yew school here. He's so much fun. But he grew up unbelievably poor.
Mm.
And we talked about that a bit. And he talked about how the library was just his savior. And also, I think it was to all the people out there who think life sometimes isn't fair. I mean, Singapore being a meritocracy allowed him to work hard and do super well in life.
Yeah, that's true.
There was nothing about who he knew. There was nothing about Nepo baby. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was all about him doing well in school, working hard, getting the scholarship to go to university, and education in the library just changed his life.
Did you ever have any standout moments with your guests that have really stuck with you?
A few. Mm. And I think probably one that I love the most is Tan Su Shan, who is set to be CEO of DBS Bank, and she's a dear friend of mine. She talked about how life is not linear. Mm. And I think for most of us, we want to get to A to Z. We want to go to 1 to 1,000 like that. You know, we just want life to be in a certain way. And she talked about how earlier in her career, she left a financial institution and she went to another, and she took 2 steps back when she took that job to take a step forward. But now she's winning the race by becoming CEO of a bank. So, you know, I mean, life is not a straight line.
Yes.
And I think when we know that the paths that take us to the wrong place mm-hmm. are teaching us something,
mm.
we just regroup and we go on another path.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is so healthy, because that will just make life better for everyone if they can understand that the wrong paths teach us stuff and it's okay.
Yeah.
Make mistakes. I always say make the mistakes early.
Because you learn so much from that, don't
yeah.
you?
Yeah.
And sometimes actually rejection is protection.
For sure.
You know?
Yeah.
You might be upset that you've missed out on something, but then it turns out the universe was just preparing you for something that was going to be even better.
Absolutely.
Who is on the wish list? Who would you absolutely love to sit down with and chat
Lawrence
to?
Lawrence Wong.
Oh, yes. So I interviewed Shazza, mm-hmm. singer-songwriter, the other day. And it's funny, she's got quite a wonderful friendship with him. So I should connect you both. Maybe she can introduce you.
Yeah. Well, I think he just has... his demands are quite high now. It's understandable he's not doing, because if he does one podcast, he probably has to do a few. And
for sure,
I can understand why he, but I think it would be fascinating to sit down with him. I think after he did his National Day speech,
yeah,
everybody was just like, felt such a sigh, such a relief, because he did such a great job. And we could see that he wasn't trying to continue to be what we had before. I mean, he wants to take the best of what Singapore has, but he also wants to make a new path.
Yeah.
And, you know, this notion that he wants to give more time for men to take off work so they can help take care of the children at home. And
love.
And also he wants to build this huge place for the athletes so that we can have more Olympians going and winning medals. I just feel like he's... he has his heart in the right place, and he's really smart, and I think it'd be fun to talk with him.
What would you ask him?
Why does he put the guitar playing on TikTok?
That's so funny, because that's actually how Shazza first got acquainted with him, because she sang the vocals over his guitar playing.
Yeah.
He was a busker, apparently. Did you know that?
I didn't know he's a busker, but... I don't know. I feel like there's a time and a place, and I'm not sure he should be doing TikTok with his guitar. But I mean, I'm obviously wrong. People like it, but.
Yeah. I mean, and you do TikTok too.
Like, yeah, I do TikTok.
I'm kind
I do
of addicted. I love TikTok. It's so much fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I do the fashion because it's easy. Mm. And it's just like a minute before I go out. And I'm all about telling people I've had this for 8 years and I'm wearing it again. And I'm all about, I've had this for 15 years, or this is new, but I paired it with this, or this is Chanel and I paired it with Target. Yeah. You know? And so I think that we do need to, this fast fashion obviously is wretched. I had Andrew Gunn on my podcast and he went on and on and on so negatively about fast fashion. But I think this notion that we buy quality and we buy, and it doesn't have to be Chanel, but we buy things that we really love and we take care of them. And then we can wear them forever and ever and ever, as long as we stay the same size.
That's a good motivation, isn't it?
Whenever my clothes get a little snug.
You're like, uh-oh, it's time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Because old Chanel is better than new Chanel.
Do you think?
Mm-hmm. Old Pucci is better than new Pucci.
Mm, I'm kind of obsessed with both those brands, and I do love the archival looks as well.
Yeah.
What episode would you recommend to new listeners?
Oh, probably the one that I did with Yip-Hin Shu. She is a 6-time gold Paralympian, and she just won in Paris this summer. And I think she's in her early 30s. And I think no one expected her to do it again. Even when we had the podcast, I think she was almost questioning if she's too old and if she can do it. And then she went and she just kicked ass and she was amazing. And I think you walk away from that, especially as an able-bodied person, thinking she's so unbelievably resilient. She doesn't, she's not packing any sort of animosity, any sort of kind of heaviness because she has to use a wheelchair. And she helped me rethink it because I'd always thought of it as a detriment. I mean, it's a wheelchair. And she was like, Paige, it's my enabler. Allows me to get through life, you know? And she's so funny. At one point I said, you know, you have to watch what you do because you're a real role model. And she goes, yeah, I'm a role model.
Stop it.
Yeah. So she's hilarious. She's smart.
That self-deprecating humor is just the best way to tackle life, isn't it?
And the whole episode was on women's bodies and aging.
So that's interesting.
We talked a lot about the Kardashians, whether it's good or bad. I mean, I just think that we covered many things. I think the episode's probably 38 minutes long. It's not very long. And she's brilliant.
What do you think about aging on that note?
It's better than the other option, but it's tough because we have such societal expectations on how we should look. So I think it's tough, and I don't fight it. I try to live now so that in 20 years I'll still be a kick-ass mom.
Yeah,
you know, and I do think it's about what you do today, especially as you get older, post 50. How you live now is really shaping your future.
Completely agree.
I think on beauty, it's a matter of eating well, not drinking too much, doing your exercise, which I do, and then taking everything. Sometimes you do drink too much and sometimes you do eat too much. So
it's about balance.
It's about balance. And also with so much technology now, you can do great things with your skin and your face and take care of yourself. So it's about, and this is another thing when I think of beauty is that I feel women often pass judgment on other women. So say my friend decides not to color her hair. I'm like, oh my gosh, why is she not coloring her hair? And then the other one is like, oh, why does she continue to color her hair? Why isn't she letting it gray? Just let people be.
It's true.
And let people, when they look in the mirror, feel good about themselves.
And with the choices they've made.
Exactly. And if that means that you want to cover the gray, then do it.
Yeah.
And I just think we should all be a little less judgmental and let people be.
Let a girl live.
Yeah.
So what is the last podcast that you listened to?
Oh gosh, I'm addicted to Huberman Labs.
Oh.
It's all about science and health and taking care of yourself.
Okay.
And I really like him so much. And then Lex Friedman. And he covers everything. He's so smart. I told my daughter Hilton, I'm like, you need to end up with somebody like Lex. But he's too old for her. I listen to a variety. I listen to Call Her Daddy. I just listened to the Kamala.
Yes, that was brilliant.
Yeah. So I listen to The Daily from The New York Times. Because I have a podcast, I am constantly listening to podcasts.
For sure.
To see how they do it and how I might do it better. And also I just think it's probably a weakness of mine, but when I'm off and I have time, I feel like it's so much more efficient if I fill it with learning.
Yeah, it's passive learning, isn't it? Yeah. So like you're cooking or you're driving.
Shower. I even listen in the shower.
Okay. I need to take it to that next level. That's brilliant.
Yeah.
And you've called yourself a tiger mom / tame tiger mom. What does that mean?
When I arrived in Singapore, I was incredibly a tiger. I mean, people, Amy Chua's book, The Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mom, a lot of people are like, oh, she's crazy. And granted, I wouldn't put my kid out in the snow because they hadn't practiced the piano. I mean, I wouldn't go to that extreme. But I really believe, and I still believe, that when children are young, if we don't push them, they will not innately push themselves. Okay. And so there's an age where you know whether or not they're academic, you know whether or not they're going to push themselves. And I mean, you kind of have to take your foot off the gas, right?
Yes.
But when they're young, if we don't push, they won't, very, very few will really push themselves. And so I believed in when my daughter would come home with a 98 out of 100, I would say, why did you miss the 2 points? And was it careless? You know, and so I really pushed. But then now 2 daughters going through the local system and being with so many other tiger moms and having a system that is incredibly academic, especially if you do DSA or you're in one of the higher classes. I mean, it's incredibly competitive. And I joke now and say, I'm the tamed tiger mom because the system has tamed me. And I see. This is something that I really am thinking about a lot. And I want to write another book about this because I think that as much as we push on the academics here, we also have to make sure that there is emotional health and that they do see sunshine. And that they are doing more than just the academic side of thing. With my daughter B, she was doing the academics, but then she was also heading the student council. She was doing debate. Even her off was on. And I think we now, as parents, the best thing we can do is, number one, figure out what our children are good at. And then that's what we tiger on.
Yeah, yeah.
Because most of us here in Singapore, we want our children to be great on the piano. We want them to be great at everything. And I would say, how many of us are great at everything?
Ooh, not me.
Right. So.
Jack of all trades, master of none.
That's how I am. My mom really believed that I should do everything. And I think one reason I went so tiger is because my mom had a career. My dad was traveling all the time for work. And I did well without working too hard. And my mom would say, did you do your best? And I would say, yes. And I look back and I wasn't really doing my best, but I did well enough, right?
Yes.
So with my girls, I wanted to make sure they did their best to see how well they could do.
Mm-hmm. It's that unmet potential, I guess, and meeting there.
And then once they get to be older and they're pushing themselves, I found myself often saying, go to sleep. It's not so important that you are the smartest one in class. And you know, but I do think initially we have to push.
Yes.
We see if they're great at football, if they're great at tennis, if they're great at singing, maybe it is academics, wherever they are very strong, that's where we spend the energy.
Yeah.
And we don't berate them if they're not smart. And it's tough in the system here.
Mm. I feel like both of them have taken on your adventurous spirit, though. Kilimanjaro.
Yes.
Discuss. Tell us about that.
Well, I've done it 4 times now.
Have you?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. There was an article maybe a month ago in the Straits Times I did on it. And I did it the first time with Jim and I was 30.
Mm-hmm.
And we showed up. We were going around the world. We showed up. I had rented boots, rented clothes. Wasn't quite like I wanted to do Kilimanjaro. So at 40, I did it alone with Abercrombie and Kent.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a luxury travel company that helps you get up in style. You still have to walk and you're still sleeping in a tent.
Yeah.
But it was very different than my first time. And the third time was with Hilton when she was 15.
Yes.
And it's funny because when she made it to the top, I was crying. And I said, I'm so proud of you. Maybe you'll do Everest one day. And she had not complained one time. And she looked at me and she said, Mama, I am never climbing another mountain again. And then B did it. And, you know, very, very, very happy to make it to the top and all that. And then 2 days later, we went on safari after we climbed. She said, Mama, I think maybe I want to do it again.
Oh, wow. So she went the other way. She's addicted to the mountain.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. But there's something about it that just, I love Tanzania itself, but there's something about as you climb, you can do it in 5 days, 6 days, seven days. But as you climb, you're having a constant change of climate around you, of foliage, of, I mean, everything is just changing from day to day. And I think it was the third time I did it, it was snow covered at the top, which hadn't happened before. And we actually had to wear cleats on our boots to get up.
Yeah.
It's just magical. And I feel for me, it's a pure reset. It's a way of just disengaging, living in the moment. This past time when we did it, I was able to get coverage one night because I would go through my pictures each day and on the phone, and you're like trying to save battery and all that kind of stuff. And I had coverage, and I literally was like, I don't want coverage. I do not want to be able to use my phone.
Off the grid.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Fair. So, because, yeah, my husband, he really wants to do it. So I'll have to message you later.
It really
get the
is.
Details.
I mean, from everyone I know who's done it, it's been a life-affirming thing.
Yes. I've heard this as well. Yeah. It's very powerful.
Yeah. But the number one thing is don't, Swahili for slowly, slowly is pole, pole. You hear the guide saying the whole way up. Pole, pole,
really?
Pole. Because the slower you go up, the more you acclimatize.
Oh, I see.
And
you're
one
probably
time,
taking it in more, right?
Yeah,
rather
yeah.
than rushing up the mountain kind of thing.
But there's a very famous school in the U.S. called West Point, and soldiers go through there. And there were four students from West Point going up. One time I was there, two boys, two girls. And the women made it up and the men didn't because they were running up the mountain.
Oh.
And my guide was like, they're never going to make it. And I was
tortoise
like, they're going to make
hair.
It. Yeah. Mm. Well, actually, they weren't that slow compared to me, but slower than the boys.
Okay, you do have a lot of passions and you pursue a lot of endeavors. I've got it listed here so I don't miss any.
Oh, wow.
Patron of the Arts, board member of United Women Singapore, GIA gemologist, TEDx speaker, spin instructor, and former columnist with The Straits Times. And there's this journalism pun that I love to use, which is that I always see myself as never the finished article. There's always something more to learn. So what is the next pursuit for Paige?
Well, I feel that one of the best things about me and one of a challenge about me is that I tend to say yes to life. And I'm actually serving on 5 boards at the moment.
Wow.
And I'm at a max. So I know that I will serve them well and I will continue to do the work that I do. It's for supporting the arts and gender equality, women's empowerment, and only 2% of Singaporeans give to the arts. So I think it's incredibly important for us to nurture that environment. So I spend a lot of time doing this work. The podcast takes some time, and I mentioned the book, and that will take probably years.
Mm.
And working on that and I guess just waiting for that next thing.
Mm-hmm.
And a few years back when NFTs and crypto became so crazy, I was on TikTok and I saw an ad from NASA Academy looking for people to make videos on NFTs and crypto with Metacoven. He was the one that bought the $69 million Beeple NFT. And so I applied. I didn't know how to make a video, but I was like, I want to learn about this. I'm going to apply. And I made a TikTok. I saved it. I sent that as my audition. I was one of 50 from around the world chosen. I was the oldest by 20 years. They're all young people, all young, young, young. And I learned so much doing it. And I mean, I don't know anything like that that's going to be down the road, but I continue to like learning about Web3, AI. I'm involved with a group in Singapore called ARC, and they do lots bridging Web2 to Web3. And I just think it is the future. And for those people who want to say, I don't like AI, well, too bad.
Yeah.
It's more like, how do we deal with it? And how do we use it as a tool to better our lives as humans? It's going to disrupt so many professions, right?
So many.
Yeah. I think just to continue to say yes, to continue to be curious, but try not to take on too much.
Mm. Yeah, that's good. That's neat. I like it. I do feel, I mean, I'm in my 40s now, and I do feel like life is getting better. And your podcast was rooted in hope.
Mm.
So what power would you like to pass to any young people watching or listening right now?
To look inside for internal validation over external validation. Because if you do that, you are going to look at what drives you, your purpose, what feeds your soul. And I think that is so important because there's so many unhappy people because they're trying to have it all as defined by somebody else. Mm. They're trying to live up to society's expectations, their parents' expectations, their boss's expectations. And so to look for that internal guide to steer you, I think is incredibly important.
We're now at the Vogue Uncut Quickfire Questions segment.
Okay.
Quick Q's, quick A's.
Okay.
You believe knowledge is power. What is one thing you wish you were more knowledgeable about?
Chinese language.
Mm.
Then I would know what my daughters are talking about.
Yeah, I know. they're saying, not behind your back, but in front of you. Okay. What do you miss most about New York?
My friends there.
Mm.
And bagels.
Oh, the bagels hit different in NYC. Imagine you have to choose a country and stay there forever, never to travel again. Where would you go or where would you stay?
One country?
That's it.
Oh my gosh, that's so hard. I'd have to be quick. Can I count the EU? Okay. If it has to be just one, then I would probably say the US, just because it's big and diverse.
And it's roots, family, friends.
Yes.
Finish this sentence. I wish I was better at
so many things. As you said, I feel like I can do a lot, but not super well. And so I wish I was better at answering these quick fire questions better. I don't have fair a succinct enough answer on that.
Because this is a podcast series, I did ask my last guest to ask my next guest a question. Mm. So this is from Gaurav Gupta, Indian couture designer. Who are you?
I am a daughter, a mother, a wife, an activist, an advocate. I am a passionate human being who feels, especially after the trip around the world, so privileged and humbled to live the life I live. And I am grateful that I'm able to spend some of my time doing for others and trying to uplift them.
Well, on that note, thank you so much, Paige. It was You're so welcome. Great having you here.
Great. Thank you.